heard the news of Philip Hughes's passing, and you know, overcome by grief, you know, as most cricket fans were. And I looked in the corner of the lounge room, and there's my bat sitting there with the hat on. Picked it up and swung it round, and you know, upset. And I thought, you know, how are we going to express this? You know, we as cricketers who played, you know, people who have played, people who play now, how are we all going to do something? And I just picked it up and I put it outside the front door and placed my cap on it and took a photo of it and then decided to send it out there, you know, to let people know, hey, this is how I'm feeling. And the rest, it just took off and had a mind of its own after that.
That's Paul Taylor. He's the Sydney man behind the extraordinary, the simple, but the suddenly global tribute to cricketer Philip Hughes. Put out your bats. You can't have missed it in these past few days, either on social media or maybe in a doorway near you. The sense of national sadness around the death of Philip Hughes has been extraordinary. And a very modern thing, I think, this conspicuous collective grief. Mourning for someone that so few of us know. And that's the interesting thing, the phenomena of what some, a little unkindly perhaps, call recreational grief. Conspicuous compassion, the mounds of flowers, the lapel ribbons, the social media outpourings, the now very familiar manifestations of a society that seems permanently on the verge of tears. A little harsh? Well, it's something that we should talk about. Joining me now, Piers Newton-John. He's a former psychotherapist, a founding faculty member of the School of Life in Melbourne, where he runs classes titled How to Face Death. Stephanie Convery is with us too, a writer for Guardian Australia and Overland, PhD in creative writing. And Dr. Margaret Gibson, senior lecturer from Griffith University and the regional representative of the Association for the Study of Death and Society. Welcome to you all. Piers, to begin with, you, we just watched that death of Philip Hughes, and it became an incredibly broad sense of grief, of sadness. How do you explain the breadth of that sense of bereavement?
I think partly it is to do with Phil Hughes personally, that he was kind of a quintessentially the Aussie battler type of thing. I think there's a lot of collective identification with him as a person. But yeah, there is an element of that sort of Princess Di kind of phenomenon, isn't there, where there was that huge public outpouring of grief that seemed somehow maybe out of proportion in terms of how well people knew her.
In a sense, we were a bit closer to Hughes because of those aspects of his character, the dinky Di kind of thing, than we were to, say, Robin Williams or Michael Jackson or Princess
absolutely.
Di.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was something really horrific about the way that he died in such a public way, and I think that really was very shocking. I remember gasping when I heard about it. In a sense, he died entertaining us, and that's really shocking and horrifying, I think.
And yet it trips into something else, doesn't it? It gets a certain social momentum, which I think is really interesting.
Yes, that's right. And one of the explanations for the huge outpouring that accompanied of grief that accompanied Princess Di's death was the idea that it was triggering other griefs and that it became an opportunity for people to express other losses in a public way, because we often don't have the opportunity to do that at the time as fully as we might like to. So we have quite a kind of very restricted idea of what an appropriate mourning period is, which is often just, you know, the funeral and a few weeks.
Yes, I mean, Stephanie, there is an element here with and the similarities in all these instances of Princess Di, Michael Jackson, Robin Williams, Philip Hughes. There's a ritualisation here. There's something in common in each of those instances.
Yes. I mean, I think it comes from something else. I actually think that it's got to do a lot with how we as a culture deal with death, deal with the idea of trauma, deal with big issues that we kind of find very hard to deal with, I think. I think we have a tendency to compartmentalize these things, like, for example, asylum seekers or war or anything big like that involves a lot of that questioning of who we are as people and what it means to be a good person to live on this planet. And then we retreat into these different social spaces like cricket or, you know, sport or media or the arts or whatever. And then when death comes and touches us there, which we kind of don't expect, we've let down our guard, suddenly it becomes a flashpoint for all of these other things. I don't think we think about them quite explicitly like that, but I think that's what happens.
And death, Margaret, is a thing that we keep at arm's length, perhaps never more so than now.
Yeah, I think that's a difficult thing, actually, because, I mean, one of the realities of modern life, and particularly in affluent societies such as our own, the death of a loved one, for example, is often deferred until the middle years or later in life. And so we're not very well prepared in our, you know, in the 21st century for the death of young people. And so I think it is particularly shocking because it is less frequent when you're living in a very well-managed, affluent society. And I think that kind of punctures us in a certain way and creates a kind of wound. And that's the element of shock, I think. As Stephanie and Piers have said, there are other factors to do with this kind of strange disconnect between people's own personal griefs that are often shut down very early and far too early for people to express them to others, and then this opening up of public mourning when it's once removed from one's own personal loss. You know, it's okay to channel your grief towards a kind of public kind of death and process your own mourning in that configuration. And I think that often does happen, which was one of the discourses around Princess Diana's death, that it enabled people to grieve their losses that had kind of been held within them and not given enough expression over time.
And then, Piers, we add into that the very modern things of celebrity, of social media, of those connections. There's a little thing I want to read to you here. A bloke called Patrick West, who was writing for a British think tank, this is back in 2004, and he's talking about hollow expressions of public caring. He says, we live in a post-emotional age, one characterised by crocodile tears and manufactured emotion, extravagant public displays of grief for people that we have never met, grief light, he calls it, or recreational grief. Does this make a certain amount of sense? That thing through celebrity of the intensity of feeling for someone we do not know, for someone we assume a connection with, that is in our minds.
Yeah. I mean, it's a harsh way of looking at it, isn't it? But I think, I mean, there is that stuff around doing the right thing because of the way we want to be perceived by others. Being conspicuously green, for example. There's a lot of research showing about the way that people behave publicly in order to show that they're good people. And this, I suppose, could tap into that urge to look like a good person.
I mean, the way, Stephanie, that we'll wear a ribbon rather than actually making a concrete contribution to a particular cause.
Yes, I think, and also in the case of social media, we often forget that social media is actually media, and it implies an audience. You know, it's a performance, a broadcast, effectively. So while we often do use it to have conversations, you know, meaningful conversations with other people, it is still a medium for broadcasting in a way. So you're always going to be removing it somewhat from the real, I think.
Which takes us into interesting territory. We were reflecting after the very sad death of Philip Hughes and the great public outpouring of sadness and grief that followed that. Piers Newton-John, Stephanie Convery and Dr. Margaret Gibson joining you. And Margaret, Stephanie was just taking us there. Is there an element of, well, almost narcissism in some of these expressions, that it's not so much about the person we are on the surface grieving, but more about us, about our display of that emotion?
I do think there's an element of that, and I think it's quite difficult to work out, you know, how and where that is happening. So, you know, you could look at a Facebook page and you can read very sort of cliched responses to things and think, well, really, how much real feeling is in that annotation of someone's outpouring of grief? And I also think some of the language that we use is a bit problematic, because, I mean, I would contest really that what we're talking about is grief as such. I mean, I think the family of Philip Hughes are actually, they're actually what we would call the bereaved. They have suffered a significant loss, and it's deeply connected to their family history, their sense of the family, of biography, of their bodies. It's connected to their bodies in real ways.
It's a response that can't be calculated. It's utterly visceral.
It is, and I think real grief actually wounds us psychically and physically. And whereas I think that at once removed, and I can recognise that this is something that has become part of the public imagination and part of the kind of rituals of forms of collective feeling and also forms of sort of remembrance. I mean, I can see that this will get remediated in the future when the anniversary comes around, which is part of the role of the media, is to remediate and reactivate our grief or our public mourning later on. I think we have to be careful about the language that we use. I think people feel sad, and I think they can feel sympathy or feel empathy if they have also gone through a bereavement.
I mean, that's an interesting point, Piers, because that sense of, I mean, grief is a very real and inescapable thing when it occurs to us firsthand. To characterise what we might feel about the death of a stranger as grief is to debase that idea. And yet that then sort of prompts what you were talking about at the beginning, that idea of touching your own sense of loss and placing that onto another person. Yeah.
I think we're certainly not bereaved, and it's important to make that distinction, but I'm not sure. I think maybe it does touch on grief. The feelings that people have do touch on their own grief. And maybe it isn't, it's not grief for Phil Hughes, who we didn't know well, but it still can have echoes of a personal grief, I think, that is legitimate. So I think it's hard to distinguish between what's authentic and inauthentic and what's show and what's genuine.
It's definitely the media aspect of this is interesting too. I mean, in the coverage, for example, of the Philip Hughes Memorial this week, we saw sort of lingering close-ups on people utterly devastated by a very serious sense of their own grief. I wonder why we are intruding on that, why we have a right to witness that.
Well, I don't think we have a right to intrude on that. I mean, I think one of the really obvious markers of the difference between the public outpouring of what I would call empathy as opposed to the personal grief of the people who were actually involved in this person's life is that those people who were actually involved in this person's life generally almost uniformly ask for privacy, whereas the media will come in and people who are not really that close to the person will come in and talk about how they feel a lot more openly, I think. And that's not to delegitimize the feelings of empathy that people are expressing, but I think there is another element to it when it comes to the media, and that the media almost always are trying to sell something, and grief sells. As cynical as that is, I think that's why we get, front covers with, memorials on them. And whenever I talk about this, I always think about Black Saturday and the ongoing newsreels and the over-the-top kind of intrusion on people's lives.
It's a difficult line, isn't it, between reporting a thing that's occurring and reporting that emotion and then using that emotion to your own commercial ends.
Exactly.
Which, Margaret, is a difficult thing. You mentioned, too, that sense of the anniversary, which will, of course, recur. And at these times, everybody says, and we will think of you forever. But of course we don't.
Yeah, very grand statements sometimes, I think. But I also think there is a kind of strange perversion that we now have because we live in a media age of mediated mourning, very expansive forms of mediated mourning. There's just so many, there's social media, there's television, there's just so much of it that we can go back and access. So I will admit to it, watching some of the YouTube videos of the public service and what struck me is that you have to watch for a number of seconds an ad on YouTube before you can see the thing that you want to see. Mm. There is all this commercialism, this advertising that comes, that sort of slips between and mediates our experiences of mourning and kind of tarnishes it and perverts it and then at the same time makes us aware, as Stephanie is saying, that it is commercial. It's a form of consumption. And so there is that kind of odd distaste that one can feel because of the nature of media in our age.
And yet, Piers, it's also possible that things like social media, that things like our great collectivity now, just make plain the true simple feelings of many people and sort of en masse as we've never seen them before in that collective sense.
Yeah, and then it gets hijacked as well by those other by those other interests.
But at the beginning, it's a simple and faithful thing.
Yeah, that's where it's difficult, isn't it, to tease out the threads of what's kind of insincere and a bit distasteful, and then what is the genuine shock and emotion that people have felt in response to it.
And we were saying, Stephanie, before we began this conversation, that a conversation like this is an awkward one.
Yes, because you don't want to devalue people's real feelings. You don't want to tell somebody that what you're feeling isn't real. What you're feeling is a performance. I don't think that's helpful, first of all. But I think empathy is a really powerful thing, and I don't think it should be devalued.
And who is anyone to say that
exactly,
of another's feelings?
Exactly. Yeah. But I think that when that gets hijacked and used for another purpose, which I think does happen in the media all the time, we see it being misused and disrespected.
Well, here we are. A short but complex examination of the three C's of modern life: compassion, caring, and crying in public. As we've seen in great evidence in this past week, sadly, around the death and the memorial for cricketer Philip Hughes, chewing over some of the issues arising from that have been Piers Newton-John, a psychotherapist formerly and founding faculty member of the School of Life, Melbourne. He runs classes titled How to Face Death. Stephanie Confrey is a writer. She is published in The Guardian, Overland. And Dr. Margaret Gibson, senior lecturer from Griffith University, the regional representative of the Association for the Study of Death and Society. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Sunday Extra here on RN.